Hello everybody and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of film. My name is Hugo Emmerzaal and I'm joined again, finally, by
Tom Holmes. Hello.
Welcome, Tom. As always, we kick off with a very important question, Tom. What have you been watching recently?
Well, I was on vacation.
Congratulations.
Thank you, finally. With my girlfriend in
Congratulations.
Spain. Thank you. While she was fast asleep, I decided to watch a film that I hadn't seen called Threads, that you might know.
Of course.
It's a 1984 TV movie made by the BBC to showcase what it would be like if Sheffield would be bombed with 300 megatons of nuclear bombs.
This is ideal holocaust holiday.
It was a bizarre situation because an artist who has a studio here in our building, he wanted to discuss with me to do a film program around the scare of the nuclear bomb, mm-hmm. Through the history of there is a new scare for a new nuclear event constantly looming over us a bit. A bit is an understatement. And he said, yeah, maybe we could do a program that goes from Strangelove to Hiroshima Mon Amour, but also towards these way more obscure things, like, for instance, Threads. And I had never seen it. And everybody told me, this is such a dire, fucked
Super
up
depressing.
Film. It's
yes.
incredibly depressing. So, in the middle of the night, my girlfriend was asleep in our hotel bed, and I thought, you know what? I'm still awake. I'm going to watch this film. I was watching it, like, her sleeping next to me. And at the end, I won't spoil anything about this, is one of the most gruesome endings I've seen in quite a while, especially in a very British film, in a way. And and I closed my laptop, and I was like, okay, I now need to go to bed.
Yes.
I do recommend everybody watch it because it is very interesting and it's very well made because it feels like almost like a documentary sometimes.
It's insanely cool. Yes.
What have you been watching, Hugo?
Well, as of recently, I'm a voting member of the Golden Globes.
My God.
Wow. Long story how you get there, but it's insane.
Who was involved giving you this fucking thing?
Massive corruption schemes.
Exactly,
that's the
exactly.
first answer. It means that every day nowadays, because award season is gearing up, like every night I wake up in the morning and I have like 10 emails of the Golden Globes with films that are being uploaded to the Golden Globes VOD viewing platform because I'm supposed to watch all of these mm-hmm. films to cast my vote for the film that will be eligible for the Golden Globes. So I'm trying to do my best and watch all of these things that are being uploaded on this platform. And some of the shit that I am watching is so incredibly bizarre and strange. Like, I recently was watching a somewhat romantic comedy with Bill Murray called The Friend, in which he immediately dies at the beginning because I think they couldn't afford him for the rest of the film. This was not good. I've watched a lot of other films that were not good, but the film that baffled me the most is a film called Rental Family.
Mm-hmm.
It's a film set in modern-day Japan starring our great friend and actor Brendan Fraser, hot off the heels after his The Whale victory, you know. He is an American man in Japan who works usually in like television commercials and stuff, and he goes for the ultimate gig, which is that he becomes like an actor for hire for people in all of these, like, let's say, family social situations. So either he has to be in a pretend wedding or he has to pretend to be a journalist to interview an esteemed Japanese film director who's suffering from dementia so that he feels accomplished, etc., etc. And then one role that he has to perform is to pretend to be the father of a young girl. And then, of course, he gets into deep, you know, because the girl is very cute. It has some of the most ridiculous pacing and shots that I've seen in such a long time. I was just constantly shocked. And also, without spoiling anything, the ending is almost as harrowing as Threads, because it's just this insane close-up on his face while he's like looking at something and reflecting life, and the close-up on his face, he's just staring and he does this like weird little smile, like and then the laugh gets bigger, almost like Joker, you know, and then he's just like laughing and feeling, I guess, happy and inspired, and smash, got to credits. And I'm just sitting there also with my girlfriend. We're like, what the fuck is going on? So yeah, I'm doing a deep adventure in these kind of like films that you would believe are fake movies set in the Seinfeld universe, or these kind of weird AI slop films that you've never heard of. I am watching them. I'm doing the Lord's work.
For them to win a Golden Globe then with...
Yeah, of course I'm going to give a vote to Rental Family. This is an instant classic in my household for sure. So yes, luckily today, Tom, we're talking about something much more exciting than Rental Family and other films that we've watched at their holiday. We're discussing the one and only, the GOAT, Jack Nicholson. I remember watching Stanley Kubrick's The Shining as a young teenager and being absolutely terrified by the horrors that slowly developed in the Overlook Hotel. Red Rum, the entity living in Danny's finger, the harrowing sense of dread that takes over the secluded location, and of course, a maniacal Jack Nicholson running after his son and wife with an axe. Recently, I rewatched the film, and it's exactly Nicholson's performance as Jack Torrance that has become even scarier than before. Rarely do you see a person so menacing, so overwhelmingly cruel and scary as in this film. My reason to revisit The Shining was for Lab 111's Jack Nicholson retrospective called Jack of All Trades, which is an aptly titled overview of one of the best actors America has ever produced. Coinciding with the re-release of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, these films explore the body of work of a genuine thespian who has conquered the silver screen with his dreadful presence, his violent bursts of anger, and his infectious energy that occasionally turns this man in an unexpected charmer. Jack Nicholson is truly a jack of all trades, capable of slipping in the most extreme roles while also being one of a kind. Few actors bring such a distinct energy with them on set, and few have mastered dramatic acting to the point Nicholson has done in a storied career that goes from the late 50s to 2010. Coming up in the mid-20th century in a string of Roger Corman-produced and directed cheapies, Nicholson embodied a new type of American, raised on the bravado of Marlon Brando but with a counterculture zeal that would be crystallized in his legendary performance in Dennis Hopper's Easy Rider. Jack was the voice of a new flower power generation, while also being the face of Americans' dark subconscious by slipping in roles of men that often turn towards violence, revealing the insidiousness of ordinary human beings in the scariest of ways. Few films captured this dynamic so well as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest by the Czechoslovakian director Miloš Forman, in which Jack is both the rebellious hero and the scheming villain of a psychiatric ward intent on brainwashing its people. His portrayal of Randall McMurphy earned Jack his first Oscar of three, a feat only done by two other actors in the history of American film. A Jack of all trades is usually followed with Master of None, but this is not the case with Jack Nicholson, one of the most masterful actors to have ever graced or haunted the big screen and today's subject for an episode of Celebrating Cinema.
Nice.
Which immediately leads me to the question, Tom. You put this program together with so many incredible films of this incredible actor. What was it like for you to revisit his roles? And what were you looking for also with compiling this program?
Well, revisiting the films was interesting because the thing that I found most interesting revisiting Nicholson, like through the various stages of his career, is that, and it's funnily enough echoed by the title that Kino in Rotterdam uses for their retrospective, which is mischievous, is that there's a certain quality to the way that Nicholson, how you perceive him on screen, there's always something just behind the eyes.
Exactly, yes.
There is a certain danger as well with the man himself. I don't know. There is the camera captures something of his essence that's not necessarily immediately nice. And I think that there are not a lot of actors that have that sort of specific melange of being charming and also incredibly dangerous at the same time on screen. And I think that's mostly the through line that I felt putting this in this sort of body of work back together in a way. And you see, because that's always funny with revisiting films for a retrospective, that you see that there's a clear evolution of how you sort of perceive him as an actor from, the, as you say, like the Corman-produced cheapies and then the pretty much the new Hollywood films like Five Easy Pieces or King of Marvin Gardens, like the very earlier work, the Bob Raffleson films that he stars in, where he's much more quiet. He's a very quiet, very enigmatic sort of character actor in a way. Well, not character actor, I would say, but there's this, his presence is much more muted, and then later on, of course, and I'm not gonna skip ahead. He much more becomes, as you said, you already mentioned the Joker in the beginning of the episode. He becomes much more a sort of a pastiche of himself,
a much
in a
more
way.
Flamboyant, overly
or
aware,
or at least more known for those moments. Because I still think that later work, whether it be a movie like As Good As It Gets or the small films that he made with Sean Penn, like The Pledge and The Crossing Guard, where there is that bravado and that... I always have to think of the Jim Carrey impersonation where Jim Carrey performs him on screen and just does the insane eyebrows.
Yeah.
That just becomes him.
Yes,
that's,
it's insane, you know, right?
It's like the same with the weird face. That's De Niro. There's these... They become like so iconified that they're just one...
Yeah, one gesture away of being mimicked.
Enough. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. You raise so many great bits. And I think, you know, you mentioned this film, Five Easy Pieces. For me, when I was, because I recently did a lecture on Jack Nicholson in the cinema to go, also with the opening of the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest restoration. And I was going through many of his films and his life and interviews and all of these things. And I thought that Five Easy Pieces was such an ideal film to also explain what is so interesting and like enigmatic and scary and exciting about Jack Nicholson.
I move around a lot. Not because I'm looking for anything really, but because I'm getting away from things that get bad if I stay.
Because here you have a man in a film that has a bit of this like laissez-faire, loose, new Hollywood structure to it. He seems to be a very blue-collared type guy, you know, a bit rough with the women, but also somewhat charming womanizer, very toxic masculine guy. This is very often an aspect of his identity or persona on screen. He's doing these odds and ends, doing very rough jobs, being very much part of, let's say, the everyday fabric of Americana. And then it's being teased that there's all of these things back home, family stuff, and he needs to go there. His trailer trash girlfriend wants to come, but he kind of dumps her on the side. And then suddenly you find out that he's actually from this super posh environment, that he was trained as a classical pianist, that he comes from this like very much silver spoon place, and all of his family members are still in that bubble. And he just consciously broke out of it, which raises the question, was he performing a version of himself in front of his family all the time before he broke free? Or is he always performing a version of himself in front of his trailer trash, Americana, you know, everyday flyover state Joes? And maybe it's both, because he's constantly suddenly this very ungraspable entity, but he has such an insane presence. And with the level of physical acting, there's this legendary scene where there's this huge... traffic jam, and he's with his co-worker in the car going to a shitty job, and they're getting super frustrated, and he jumps out of the car and just starts screaming and barking against dogs. And
well, we all line up like a goddamn bunch of ass, the most beautiful part of the day in
jumping on other cars just to show the mania of people being stuck in traffic to go to their fucking job. So again, like I said, in the cold open, he starts to symbolize something that's in every person in America, this frustration with their surroundings. And it's an ideal film to explain him, because he can move across the spectrum anytime he wants. And it seems like just one, you know, one tiny little thing has to go off in his head and he can just become violent, dangerous, explosive, or incredibly funny and charming.
Yeah.
And it's so cool. It was so exciting to watch.
And I think that, because I love Five Easy Pieces. It blew me away the first time I saw it. It's like you mentioned the entire, you find out that he goes home and that he's actually from a very intellectual, well-to-do background. And I love the fact that Bob Raffleson, the director, shows that in almost one shot. He's yes. like playing piano and the camera just sort of glides through the room and you see all these old pictures of like a lineage of yes. intellectuals that he came from. You're like, wait, what? This guy is he indeed, as you say, like acting as though he's blue collar? Is he escaping something or what is he escaping? And the funny thing is that duality is perfect for Nicholson. I think that is exactly what he is always. He always feels he lures you in, but never lures you in enough. So it's like you're always thinking like, wait, what is this guy? Who is this guy? What? And also in real life.
Yes.
Because the funny thing about, to go very meta on this maybe, Raffleson tells this beautiful story that at the end, his sort of catatonic old father that doesn't speak anymore, he has a sort of final conversation with him.
Yes, exactly.
Or a conversation monologue.
Yes, he talks at his demented father. Yeah. Yes.
At the end of that monologue, Nicholson, or his character, breaks up in tears. And it's one of the most beautiful, honest, crying performances you'll ever see in a film. And Raffleson said that Nicholson was a very easy guy to work with. But for that scene, he said, okay, Bob, can I ask you, please just turn on the camera and walk away.
Yes, insane.
And it was just him and the actor who plays his father, yeah. and everybody needed to leave because he was going to put something in that scene that was specifically yeah. coming very deep down from inside of his, probably maybe his own relationship with his father or something very methody.
Yes.
And you feel, you can feel it going through the screen, the reality of maybe, but you're never really quite close enough to still knowing who Nicholson
this
is.
This is a perfect point because I was reading a lot and there's actually not that much written about the Nicholson acting philosophy, mm-hmm. right? What kind of actor is he? Is he a method actor or is he just one of those insane people that can intuitively yeah. kind of like slip into a role and just basically win everything? In a much later interview, he once said that also he acknowledged that this aspect of his career is very often unexplored. And he said that it's essentially one of the greatest compliments he got, because it means that people don't have that grasp even still at the end of his career. And he said, academically speaking, I know more about method acting probably than any other actor working right now. I know everything about it, and I will use a lot of it probably in my performances too. However, I'm completely not tied to it, which also means that I have this insane freedom, which also explains that people don't really know who is this guy, you know? And when he started coming up in these like early films in the late 50s, early 60s with Roger Corman, who was like an icon, of course, of like cheap B exploitation films. Yep. And he gave a lot of emerging voices from the new Hollywood era their first shot at making it in the movie business. Nicholson was very aware of this lineage that he stepped in, that he was very aware of the guys like James Cagney, James Dean, Marlon Brando, who were the real screen icons of the 1930s and 40s, and what their acting style was. And he always said, I have a bit of this old-timer guy in me, and he wanted to fuse that with that more unknown part yeah. that was going to creep up in America on a more sociological level.
Yeah, the countercultural vibe that you mentioned in your cold open.
And then I find out that actually also in terms of like his thinking about performances, but also as himself as a screenwriter and a director, because he also directed a couple of films, wrote a couple of scripts, some of them good, some of them whatever, but still most of them interesting, is that he was insanely aware of what was going on in society at large and how he should position himself vis-a-vis those things. Like Easy Rider for him, he knew this film was going to pop because he knew that this biker culture, flower power, hippie thing just needed a bit of an intellectual experimental push and it will just capture the zeitgeist. So he was immediately on board, you know? So he had a very strong sense of curation and I think that kind of honed in that level of mystique that we're now trying to capture. Mm-hmm. And he was very conscious of how to utilize that to become what was essentially at some point the most in-demand actor at the time in the 60s and 70s, for sure.
Do we know what made him want to be an actor in the first place?
He was like from a relatively, in that sense, less important family, but he had relatives in California, and he just knew that he wanted to do something in film. He wanted to act and he wanted to meet stars. And his first break in the film industry was he wanted to meet stars, so he got a job in the office in the animation department of MGM, and he was almost being recruited to become an animator.
Really?
In one interview, they actually asked him, and can you draw? And he was like, well, I can draw a little, but I just wanted to be an actor, ultimately seeing all these stars. And then he got scouted by one of the heads of the studio to go in a talent program, to learn how to do the actual craft, to act on stage, to become ready to act in front of the camera. And then through Roger Corman, he kind of broke through a bit. But he also said of this like first decade before he really popped off with Easy Rider and Five Easy Pieces in relatively quick succession, that he was already acting in quite some films, some of them actually really good, but that he was never becoming a star. He was just an actor in Hollywood, right? And this was for him the most frustrating moment in his career, he said, because it's worse to be there a bit, but not quite reach your dream, than to be at the beginning and still have this dream wholesale intact. So he's like, I lost a bit of my naivete and I'm still not a star.
Right.
So he was also, I guess, scheming quite hard how to get to that point. And then once Easy Rider had its world premiere at the Cannes Film Festival, people were shocked, of course, and he knew. Baby, we're in. I'm a star now. And that's kind of how it went.
And then it snowballs quite a bit, of course, because then I think the bigger one after that is Chinatown, right?
Relatively soon after, I mean.
We need to get a timeline here.
Yeah, the last detail.
Oh, yes, set, of course. Yes. Yeah, you get the well, this is all much, very much, of course. All these films from this specific period are very much part of the new Hollywood lineage, and I kindly advise everybody to listen to the episode that Elliot and me recorded on that.
Exactly, it's great.
Because otherwise we're going to overlap a lot, I think, here.
But what I can say very briefly about this era that is also relatively underexplored, which I was also shocked about, was that after he had his premiere, world premiere in Cannes in the late 60s with Easy Rider, he was vibing with Jean-Luc Godard, he was vibing with François Truffaut, he knew Pasolini. Of course, he knew Michelangelo Antonioni because they made a film in 75 together, The Passenger. He knew Bernardo Bertolucci. He was in touch with all of the major European directors of the 1960s and 70s in this time, which also influenced his acting a lot because he understood that acting in America is usually something different than acting in Europe. You're a different tool for a European director than for an American one.
Yeah.
In America, you're usually a face and a body. In like in Europe, you could say that you're much more of a complex entity with all of these tiny gestures and conceptual implementations. Like, who are you in this story becomes much more complicated in a Pasolini film or an Antonioni film than in, you know, your American genre counterpart. So he learned a lot about this and also learned how to implement that in Hollywood vis-a-vis his own acting, which I think also explains the insanely ambitious and super, like, formerly impressive films that he manages to do once the big, big success really comes, which is what you were hinting at, films like Chinatown.
I'm happy that you mentioned The Passenger, because I do agree that you see in that film that he is very much able to... He's great at dialogue, but The Passenger, I mean, Antonioni films usually don't have a lot of dialogue. He needs to just be a glance. And he can act with his eyes amazingly well. And you see that in The Passenger incredibly well.
And it's so cool because Antonioni is like making metaphysical films almost.
Exactly.
Right? Every gesture is atomized. And yeah, the fact that he can pull this off too, it's cool.
It does feel fascinating that that's such an energetic powder keg of a personality, at least that's how you would perceive him watching the later work, can be so restrained to an extent that he's still playing with what he has.
And isn't it then ironic that restraint is very often, you know, a recurring theme in the characters that he plays? Because if you look at Chinatown, Roman Polanski's great neo-noir thriller,
Los Angeles, 1937. There are lots of guys like J.J. Gittes. They're easy to find, if you want to find them.
Mr. Gittes, have we ever met?
Well, no.
Never?
Never.
Since you agree with me that we've never met before, you must also agree with me that I've never hired you to do anything, certainly not spy on my husband. I don't get tough with anyone, Mr. Gittes. My lawyer does.
In which there's all of this, like, mass corruption, kind of, like, intrusion, crime things happening. Everything is very seedy. There's this very, like, almost like conspiratorial aspect mm-hmm. to all of these things that he's uncovering in California as a private detective. But he has to kind of always keep his cool in the face of all of this blatant evil that is slowly emerging. And then, you know, with, of course, a film like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, restraint is all about it. Like, how can we tame all of this energy that is inside him? Because it's too propulsive for all of these people in this psychiatric ward. You know, it's too infectious almost. And then the film like Shining also shows where things can go when this restraint gets like too deep in him and he mm-hmm. needs to lash out to free his own ego or super ego or whatever. And, you know, so it's like very often these characters are also tiptoeing between where to show restraint and mm-hmm. where to just let go.
Let it go, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's an interesting observation. I do think that is a through line. Maybe that's also what makes his bursts of insanity more interesting, is that he can also tone it down to a quiet extent, you know? And I think, well, talking about insanity, as you said, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which I should mention, we, with our distribution company, are re-releasing now in the Benelux again.
Do you think there's anything wrong with your mind, really?
Not a thing, Doc.
Excuse me, miss. Do you think it might be possible to turn that music down so maybe a couple of the boys could talk?
Your hand is staining my window.
Jesus, I mean, you guys do nothing but complain about how you can't stand it in this place here, and then you haven't got the guts just to walk out. I mean, what do you think you are, for Christ's sake, crazy or something? Well, you're not.
I hadn't seen it since I was in my early 20s, and I saw it I saw this restoration for the first time on the piazza in Bologna,
Cinema Ritrovato,
the Bologna Italian Film Festival, specifically focused on restorations of classics. It was one of those nights where the piazza was just completely jam-packed, like people sitting on the stairs of the church that's there with like pizzas they brought them from like a little shop around the corner. I remembered the movie itself as much more of a maybe not commercial, but much more one of the acclaimed classics. You know what I mean? It's one of the three that won the Big Five Academy Awards. And then when I rewatched it, I realized it's much more of a... It's clearly a movie by a Czechoslovakian director.
It's so funny how in memory you take these films kind of for granted because they have this pop cultural image. And then you revisit the film, you're like, this was quite bonkers, you know. Yeah. There's some really strange things in it. Not all of it, I have to say, fully works because you also feel this awkwardness of this Czechoslovakian director moving through Hollywood. But all of it is fascinating. Yeah.
What I also had completely forgotten about it, that what Nicholson beautifully does, like in the beginning, you think he's this guy who's feigning insanity so he can get out of labor during his prison time. And I thought, especially in the beginning of the film, you think he's also kind of a bit of a dick.
Yes, of course.
You think he's clearly also, he's there for quite a grimy reason, I remember.
Yeah, some sexual assaults.
Assaults, you know, so it's like, what? And then, but what the movie perfectly does is that he becomes this, I wouldn't say a messiah, but he does.
Anti-hero.
He becomes such an anti-hero and such a compassionate character. You via him, he's clearly the good kicking against the system. You know, the system being Nurse Ratched, portrayed by Louise Fletcher as this terrible oppressive entity.
authoritarian figure. Yeah, there are some interesting bits about this film because Miloš Forman came, of course, from Czechoslovakia. He made a great film there at the end of his career in Europe called The Fireman's Ball. Mm-hmm. And he was already long on the list to be the director to adapt the book that One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was based on. And actually, Kirk Douglas's production company already reached out to him once a long time ago. Do you want to adapt this book? And he had said yes. But there was a problem. He was still stuck in Czechoslovakia. Then, of course, you have like the spring of 68 and the Russian tanks invading Prague and all of these things. And he decided to really flee to America. And then it was actually Michael Douglas, Kirk Douglas's son, who was also running this production company, who again approached Miloš Forman. Do you want to adapt this book? Not knowing that his dad had asked the exact same question to him before.
Yeah.
So it's like an insane coincidence that the same book falls on the lap of this director twice and now finally he's in a position to make it.
Yeah.
Jack Nicholson was first not supposed to be the main actor.
Douglas was supposed to be one of them.
But one of them was too old and the other would be maybe a bit uncomfortable if the son would do it instead of the dad.
Just a bit of context. Why would they ask Miloš Forman?
Because they were very impressed by his films, because they were looking for somebody to capture this spontaneity of the story, the insanity at the heart of it. And they had met him before and they had seen his work before. And of course, this is the time when American studios are looking at European hot directors that are also, frankly, anti-communist, that could actually perform in this capacity as an interesting art out there in Hollywood.
And also a bit cheaper.
Yep.
To be honest, I think maybe there's also a financial aspect. These are smaller production companies that might need somebody who would be interested to work a bit more on a dime. And, you know, this is a good combination of the two.
And then the interesting thing is that for me, on a meta level, the film is about two entities, two forces also within the film and in the background. It is Miloš Forman's film as an author, but it is also Jack Nicholson's film.
Yeah.
And the irony is that apparently there are stories that on set, they never spoke. They never directly communicated with each other. The only communication was through intermediaries. I don't even know why, if there was a concrete beef or if they didn't just entirely gel or something. But it's very clear that Jack Nicholson is taking a lot of anatomy and agency on his part to put the part exactly like he wants it. While Miloš Forman is invested in showing the film from a completely different perspective, which is mainly Nurse Ratched's authoritarian display in the psychiatric hospital reminds him of the communist authoritarian state that he fled in Czechoslovakia. And he said, Nurse Ratched, like, communism was my Nurse Ratched. I identify with it because I have seen all of these things firsthand. I've lived it and I've escaped it. So he has a different point to prove, and Nicholson has a different point to prove. And you feel this chaos in the film sometimes a bit, where to put more focus. But this is also very interesting that you have two of these like super bright, you know, keen entities in the film that are fighting basically for their own, like, let's say, position within the center of the story. It's super cool. It's very interesting.
It makes the movie better. It does.
It was a pleasure to rewatch it, honestly. Yeah. And it's also, like, again, the point where everything for Nicholson clicks. Because all of these points that we are making are suddenly so explicit, right, in the character. And he wins his Oscar. And then from there, it's basically an insane victory lap for him, taking a lot of risks still, but also just being so insanely in demand. Kubrick is already calling him if he can be in Napoleon, the film that never materialized, but he was being cast in Napoleon. All of these directors are knocking at his door. He can ask ridiculous fees suddenly for his acting. He was earning up to $10 million on average per role that he performed. This is insane.
Yeah.
He was like hotshot, playboy, top of the bill guy suddenly.
This is also the time, not to turn this into a gossip episode suddenly, but this is also the time he's going with Angelica Houston, right?
Yes, and this
and
is...
And sadly also very much being with Angelica Houston, but also going with a lot of other women.
Yes, he, like, and on the record in interviews, I've read a lot of interviews, he's a, like, very, let's say, avid womanizer, and he's very much into this aspect of the lifestyle as well. I think, obviously, there's a lot of bad choices being made here as well. There's a lot of marriages. There's a lot of ex-wives. There's a lot of children. There's like in one late interview when he's at the end of his career, he's describing how he's still somewhat together with his spouse, but that they are living in separate houses and yeah, that yeah, he just yeah, occasionally yeah, yeah. comes over to be with the kid. But I'm a great father. I love the children, but he's just like he knows what he wants. He knows what life wants to bring him and what he wants to bring for life. And it's different thing than I think settling down and having an ordinary yeah. family life. And he's always lived that stuff, like going on adventures, spending lavish money on like big trips. He has an insane art collection, apparently. Mm. People say he has the best art collection of all actors and Hollywood adjacent people there is. So wow. he's an avid collector, avid reader, womanizer. He just likes the good things in life,
yeah,
I guess.
He has lived.
Yes.
That can be said. Coming back to a bit of a timeline of his career, you said like he's being paid a lot of money. I would reckon he was paid a lot of money, in especially because we're going to the early 80s now. The insanity that he portrays in Cuckoo's Nest is, funnily enough, very much expressed in a much more kookier way and a much more extreme way in the first Batman movie.
Yes, my God.
Jack, listen. Maybe we can cut a deal.
Jack is dead, my friend. You can call me Joker. And as you can see, I'm a lot happier.
A film that I very much did want to include, because I, you know, it is a very interesting thing for him to do. He's played in The Witches of Eastwick, just, I think that's
87.
It's 87, right? Yeah. So, and Batman is 89. And in The Witches of Eastwick, he goes mad a lot of the time. It's almost like he takes the role of the Joker to make it the extreme of what it can be. Like,
exactly.
He plays a character that's maniacally insane. How do you look at Tim Burton's Batman?
Well, I have like super fond memories of this film as a kid because one of the first CDs that I owned was the Prince soundtrack Batman. And I was very young when my dad gave it, which also prompted a lot of rewatches of this film. And I thought it was absolutely fantastic. And I thought the Joker was very cool. But recently I was rewatching it a bit. And it's just fascinating because it's like, at first, he's your typical, let's say, DC universe scheming mob type villain, right? Mm-hmm. And then he gets like in a devastating, violent accident and he gets some surgery done and he becomes the Joker. And then everything just becomes one insane farcical thing after the other. The scene in which he kind of is introduced for the first time proper as the Joker and he comes to pay some retribution to one of his like old crime fellows, and he starts shooting him like a copious amount of times with his guns till the gun clicks empty and he's just like waving it around and he's like, oh, what a day, and he's doing all of these clown things and the music becomes so insanely comical. You're like, okay, this is crazy, we're now going fully overboard. The cool thing is, I would say he still manages to keep it controlled enough that it's cool to watch. Like, it's interesting acting. He's doing interesting bits. But it is the definition of grotesque. Yeah. And this dynamic range suddenly collapses on itself. It's like going from 0 to 100 and then back, but mostly stay at 100, 200, 300, you know. The subtlety is kind of like lost in the plot here.
Mm-hmm.
How was it for you?
Have you ever danced with the devil in a pale moonlight? Generally, I think it's fascinating to see the older comic book films again because, I mean, I remember them from seeing them when I was young on VHS and then sometimes on TV. But then when the friend of the podcast, Christopher Nolan, made his...
never forget. Best bud.
Made his Batman movies, everything became so serious, much more serious that it's... that it's funny if you look back at those films. They're so kooky, but they're kooky in a way that they're not as kooky as the Adam West Batman stuff. No. You know, there are
those are just mostly silly, and yeah. There you have this silly like right real yeah. like modern like urban gothic streak in Tim Burton's sensibilities. There's some interesting like cyberpunky aesthetics going on.
Yeah.
Jack Nicholson, the Joker, is insanely well-dressed and, like, super yeah. nicely stylized. And his performance is insanely stylized as well. But there's interesting bits in it happening. Yeah. Except there's not really emotional density to it, right?
No.
Yeah.
No. But they are very much, much more closer to what the comics really were. That I very much enjoy, you know? And I think that's he is perfectly cast, actually, in that role. It makes complete sense that it's him. And also, there's this thing that sometimes you don't really feel anymore. It was quite exciting that Jack Nicholson was exactly, playing because that he's character. Huge.
And also, I mentioned before that on average, he would bucket like $10 million for a role, right?
Mm-hmm.
With his role as Joker in Tim Burton's Batman, he collected as much as up to $66 million for his role. Because he was unpaid on contract and he got like...
And revenue share.
Damn. After the premiere. So this is one of the most profitable roles also in the history of cinema, basically.
Yeah, and I think that generally he did that pretty often because he also got a revenue share from Cuckoo's Nest, if I'm not mistaken.
He's a
very good entrepreneur.
He's a very insane businessman yeah. and he was like super locked in again with the culture. He was like mm-hmm. reading a lot of theory, a lot of academia. He was very well versed. He also like played an Irish poet in a like real life story in the film Reds in 1981.
Movie, yeah,
the Warren Beatty film, because he very much identified with this Irish poet who also was from an emigre family from Ireland to America, all of these things. So there is like this intellectual streak, but the irony is that we're now in a moment in his career, which has also, of course, happened with, I guess, Nicolas Cage to a different degree, where the sincerity and this kind of like iconic aspects of his acting are turned into like a farcical thing to exploit by the right film and the right director. And it never veers off in this like relentless slob that Nicolas Cage found himself in at some point. But there is this moment, right, where you stop watching Jack Nicholson disappear in a role and you're seeing Jack Nicholson as the role, but he will always be Jack Nicholson.
Yeah, and there's an expectation of, because then we're coming up towards A Few Good Men, which I do think is a very good film.
Great one.
And I think the nasty Colonel Nathan Jessup is the character that he plays in that film is perfect for him. He can chew the scenery, of course, but there is also now the expectation of you seeing Jack Nicholson on
exactly.
screen.
Yeah,
it's not much so much about the character only. It's also, oh yeah, it's Jack Nicholson.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth. Son, we live in a world that has walls, and those walls have to be guarded by men with guns. Who's going to do it? You, Lieutenant Weinberg? I have a greater responsibility than you can possibly fathom. You weep for Santiago, and you curse the Marines. You have that luxury. You have the luxury of not knowing what I know. That Santiago's death, while tragic, probably saved lives. And my existence, while grotesque and incomprehensible to you, saves lives.
And then, ironically, like, this is the moment with A Few Good Men, but a decade plus later with The Departed by Martin Scorsese. There's this moment where Nicholson has to do this thing where he's passing the baton. Because A Few Good Men is an insane standoff between him and Tom Cruise, but also between the acting styles of him and Tom Cruise and the energy in the room, because they're both already then larger than life personas, yep. right? And in The Departed, he literally takes on this kind of like father figure role in the film, in the crime capacity as a mob boss, Leonardo DiCaprio's character, who's like stuck between being an undercover cop or being actual, you know, just like henchman guy coming up in the ranks mm-hmm. of the criminal organization that Nicholson's character runs. And here you see this very like paternal kind of like Nicholson bestowing some of this like acting magic to DiCaprio, who's always said that Nicholson was one of his biggest inspirations as an actor himself as well. So there's also this like awareness, I guess, for him of aging and then where to put himself within his roles. Yeah. Because he becomes more aware that he can't just do the same thing over and over again. These are very scary and interesting moments to see usually in a career of a celebrated actor. Do they age gracefully? Do they completely sell out? Do they start making all of these weird satires of their own, you know, skill and greatness? And I think Nicholson, all in all, was pretty good at tiptoeing that line.
The only person that I really think about when it comes to such a thoughtful career with not too much fat on, unnecessary fat on the career, is somebody like maybe Robert Redford, which is funny because he comes from the exact same New Hollywood starting point.
Exactly.
Also was very much in control of the movies that he played.
Insanely entrepreneurial as well.
And a great activist and a great, all in all, like very much a movie star, the same enigmatic quality on screen where you never really know what is going on. But the big difference between Redford and Nicholson, of course, there is no insanity with Robert Redford.
No, he plays it much more straight.
He plays it straight. He is much more a sort of a blank slate that you can beautifully project onto. And Nicholson is very much brings something to the table that needs to be reckoned with when you watch his films. There's clearly somebody there. And talking about passing the baton, this might be a bit random, but I always have to think about, you mentioned The Departed, and I think Matt Damon now has three stories that he tells on every freaking talk show that he goes to. And one of my favorites is that he's talking about, he always gets the question, like, how was it to work with Jack Nicholson?
Yeah, of course.
And then he says, well, the funny thing was that we were shooting a scene, and it's the scene where it's him and Ray Winston, and they're disposing of a body. So they're shooting the scene, and Matt Damon is not in that scene. He was just standing around on set. He says, like, so what Nicholson does, it's literally one page. It just says Ray and Frank, the character of Jack Nicholson, are in the marshes. They dispose of a body.
One line.
And then apparently Nicholson constantly goes towards Martin Scorsese. You could end the scene there, but if you leave the camera rolling, I pick up an axe and I say to Ray, maybe I should have sex with her one more time. Now that's a very sinister thing to say. And you could end the scene there, but if you leave the camera rolling...
He's just giving all these insane options.
It just goes on and on and on.
Much more demented and crazy.
And it makes it crazy. And he just becomes, the scene becomes crazier and crazier. And then Matt Damon says, like, wow, Jack. And then Jack says, yeah, I'm not only a good actor, but I'm also a great fucking writer.
That's so good.
It's like, jeez.
Well, it reminds me of one thing that my buddy, Alexander Payne, but a little humble brag. But what he told me when I asked him, like, I'm going to do this lecture on Jack Nicholson and Jack Nicholson's start in a great film of his called About Schmidt, so in which beautiful. He is a man who has dementia and he goes on this like road trip to basically sort his life out because there's a lot of regret and things to sort. It's one of the few late films of Nicholson where you stop looking at Nicholson and you see the Schmidt character first and Nicholson second, instead of the other way around. And I asked Alexander Payne, the director, if he could give some anecdote what it was like to work with Nicholson. And basically what he said was that Nicholson, on the day of, like, at the beginning of the day of shooting, when you're preparing the blocking and the mise-en-scène and where does the camera go and which actions do we film and this and that, that he never asked or never needed, and he actually consciously told Alexander Payne, I don't need motivation. You don't have to ever explain me why I am doing the thing that I have to do. I am perfectly smart enough to think of my own motivation. I can do that entirely by myself. And then he said that it was super chill because he was just like we said, he would slip in the role. Mm-hmm. Some magic would happen, and it's hard to tell what that magic exactly is. And he would just deliver. And you would never have to explain Jack Nicholson why he is doing the thing that he's doing. He's there, and he's ready to go. And I think this is like the less insane continuation of this Departed thing, that he's just always ready to play ball, you know? He can just do it. If you want something a bit more nutty and insane and evil and violent, he can do it as well, you know?
Yeah. He's always ready. He's not going to explain where it came from, but it just came from somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah. This is insane. That's the thing. There is some magic happening, right? And I think for a person that has worked for so many decades, the fact that it's still so consistently palpable throughout his entire career, this unspeakable magic of what acting really is, it's quite insane. And this is, I think, the thing I learned the most from revisiting a lot of his films as of late.
So he stops acting in 2010 with an incredibly forgettable movie by James L. Brooks that he worked with on As Good As It Gets, one of my late-stage Nicholson favorites, where he plays a challenged, very in all ways challenged writer of these incredibly stupid novels that falls in love with a waitress played by Helen Hunt. It's such a weird, typical 90s sort of romantic.
And it's great, it works. And whereas, it really works. How do you know from 2010, his last role, it's so forgettable, nothing is happening there.
Yeah, so he stops acting, this is 14 years ago. We haven't heard from him really since. Quite recently he suddenly popped up to say welcome to Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
During the anniversary of Saturday Night Live. Apart from that, he's watching basketball games with his with one of his sons, I think.
Yes.
But that's mainly it.
He's
kind of disappeared.
People asked him as well, why did you quit and don't you miss it? And he said, I'd rather be sitting under a tree reading a book than doing anything I don't want to do.
Right.
And I think he just exhausted it. He just completed it. I think it's just like if this acting thing for him was a big game to show that he's the best at the game, because I think he kind of has this mindset. He just knew that he did it, you know, he completed it. And he sees all of his peers like Robert De Niro and Al Pacino performing all this cringe. And I think he's very smart to know not to do that. Also, he became a bit less beautiful, a bit more bulky, a bit more, you know, nasty, disgusting old man. I think he just wanted to save face and think, I have a shit ton of money. I can still, you know, womanize. I can still have fun. I can go basketball games. I can do this and that. Why would I even need to go on a set and do all of this shit when I don't even want to? And he's just enjoying life. He seems to be like a real bon vivant. This is like the summary of his life, I think. Just always trying to have as much fun as possible while doing it.
Yeah.
Legendary run. What can you say? Congratulations.
Absolutely. It's 77 film or 70 movies, I think. And most of them are bangers. So, Hugo, maybe to wrap this up, I'm going to ask you, like, what do you think Nicholson's legacy as an actor, but maybe also as a just a screen icon is, and how that maybe do we still see remnants of his persona or his work or his or the way that he made films in the way that actors now work in Hollywood?
Well, I think that like the genuine legacy is that a man who would not I'd be identified as the typical all-American, let's say, sex kind of like bomb, you know, the most typical handsome man, that he managed to actually become still one of the most celebrated and iconic actors within that capacity. And that has to do a lot with that actually maybe what we prefer in interesting characters and great performances is a great sense of unpredictability, tumultuous interiority, all of these things that he symbolized in his most iconic roles. So I think it's a great sign that he becomes so popular to begin with. And I think there are a couple of actors that still take a lot of inspiration from that. I do, even though I am less fond of him, I do appreciate that Leonardo DiCaprio manages to take on films and roles in which he's also portrayed less handsomely and less as like the heartthrob and more as, you know, this weird complicated figure, like in one battle after another. DiCaprio is not trying to be hot. He's not trying to be, you know, all-American guy. He's a very messy, complicated man, you know? This is, I think, a bit of the Nicholson streak that is in him as well. I see some of it in the daring roles that Robert Pattinson takes as well, and this, like, physical form of acting that he's done in the Safdie Brothers films, for instance, and in some other work. But I also think that this level of like toxic machismo cool that emerged from the 70s and crystallized in the 80s is very much a thing of its era. Mm-hmm. And I think that Nicholson was the best at utilizing that you could get away with a lot of shit by being just so incredibly charming while being so fucking toxic. He is, in that sense, he's a piece of work, you know? And you don't see that often anymore. No. Also because like people's social lives are a bit more sanitized and scrutinized. So do you have anyone to add, like, in terms of
legacy? I think actually those two are great examples. I did not think about, I mean, I thought about DiCaprio and didn't think about Pattinson. That's actually a good example of somebody who also, of course, those two also kind of escaped the pigeonhole that they found themselves in from the earlier point of their career.
Teen heartthrob stars.
And you could say that maybe if you want to make the comparison fully is that Nicholson came from the Corman Little Shop of Horrors to wrap this episode up nicely in a bow. And Pattinson came from Twilight and DiCaprio came from, let's say, little movie called Titanic.
I don't know it.
No. Never heard of it. And they sort of took that start not to to lavish in that pigeonhole, but to completely, immediately fly out of it and do with Pattinson Cosmopolis and et cetera, et cetera. And,
to use your stardom for your own gains and most importantly, your own autonomy as an artist and creator. And I think that's the red line, the through line of Nicholson's acting work. He always believed that is as a very genuine art that should be taken insanely serious, that you can actually overthink because the results are indescribable, but everybody in the audience knows it when acting is good and they feel it when acting is great. And this is what Nicholson did, and this is, I think, what still is so inspirational about so many of his roles. So yeah, that's all the more reason after this conversation to go to Lab 111 and to watch all of the films of Jack Nicholson in the Jack of All Trades retrospective.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab 111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzall and artwork from Studio FFF.